My name is Carol Avery. My fourth day on talking about different aspects of Saudi Arabia. Today I wanted to cover what it's like raising children in a foreign country. And the only foreign country I know about raising children in is Saudi Arabia. So if anybody else has other experiences in other countries, I'd be interested in hearing it. Probably the best place to start is at the beginning, which is having children. The first time we went over and got on the big 747 in New York, we met several couples who were going to the same university, returning university. One woman was about 5 months pregnant. Another man was there with his 5 children all the way down. His wife would have gone ahead or something. And right away they tried to tell us how pregnancy runs an epidemic proportion in Saudi Arabia. They tried to tell me it's something you catch in the pool. And after this, I think maybe he's right. I don't know how else this one came about to be. But there are so many, I think because there's so many couples our age with young children, it seems like every year there's this whole cycle of babies being born, which is kind of exciting. There's a lot of people to communicate with, to gather with, and we meet before I started working, we were meeting once a week with a baby group, just getting together with our little ones, and we actually had split into 3 baby groups because you keep getting, the tiny babies were suddenly a year old, and then there's a whole new set of little babies. So it's fun that way. Coming back this time, I was flying on Lufthansa from Tehran to Frankfurt, and there was an elderly gentleman sitting next to me who had gotten on the plane, and about halfway he looked at me and he said, "I think this must be the pregnancy express." There were so many of us pregnant. And I said, "Well, yeah, I guess you're right." Kind of embarrassing. So I must say, when we moved there, we had in mind wanting to have another child, and I was a little nervous at the thought of having a child in a foreign country. It's hard to call Saudi Arabia a third world country anymore because they've come so far and so technological. So it was encouraging for me right away to meet a lot of people who had just had children or were about to. And I immediately chose the hospital that my friends had gone to just because they could give me a good recommendation and liked the gynecologist and liked the hospital. So I started going there then, but actually going to the hospital to see the gynecologist. And the hospital is very modern, has probably some of the highest technological equipment there, but it's very old-fashioned in a way. I think it's much like hospitals were in our country probably 30 or 40 years ago. Everything very white and sterile and shiny. You don't feel homey. I know lots of hospitals now, they try to have carpeting in the lounge and try to make it feel not so much like a hospital. And this hospital feels very much like a hospital. But it's very nice. The way that the procedure in that country, as in many actually, is generally to have a midwife, and you only see a doctor if you're having a problem, basically. And I had no objection to that. There is one gal there from Ireland who works at the hospital, midwife, and I had hoped that she would be on duty when I delivered, and she was. She's a wonderful lady. But hers is an unusual situation because she's in the country as a single woman, which is very few and far between jobs for single women. And she's one of them. I feel sorry for every year she says, "This is it, I'm not coming back." And every year she does, and I hope she'll be there in the fall. But she actually has to live right at the hospital too. So her whole life, she works 6 days a week. She lives at the hospital, a little apartment in the back. And that's her whole life. Of course, she can't really get out and do much. But she meets a lot of us who are there having babies, and we always try to involve her in our activities at home and such, which I think she appreciates. Other than that, all the midwives are mostly Korean, Indian, Pakistani, which is fine. I had no objection, except my only concern was a communication problem when you're in labor and you're not always communicating very coherently anyway. I was just kind of concerned about having someone that I couldn't communicate well with, and that didn't happen with me. But all I think are very competent. I didn't have any concerns about who I would have. So when you go into the hospital, finally, for the delivery, in my case, I was induced, so it was all done very, I had an appointment in the morning, and I was over 2 weeks along and just about ready to deliver anyway, so it was very easy. We just went to the office and signed in. And one thing you do is you fill out a card and specify on there if you have a girl, if you want her ears pierced, and if you have a boy, if you want him circumcised. The Muslim way is to circumcise boys and to pierce the little girl's ears. And I had a heck of a time not having Kristen's ears pierced, as much as we had signed the form saying, no, we didn't want that done. And but every time her little bassinet came rolling in, there kept being a sign on there that said, for ear piercing. And I kept telling them, no, I don't want her ears pierced, I take it off. And then the next time it came in, there would be a sign saying, for ear piercing. But we didn't have her ears pierced. And an Egyptian neighbor of mine still thinks that that's awful. She's still trying to convince me to have it done. Because especially,
why do they do it? Why do they pierce it?
It's just custom. Just custom. Yeah, they do. Tiny little babies with their little. No, I just think it's one way to tell a boy from a girl. And especially because Kristen looks so much like a boy, they really think that. Yeah. They just, oh, she's just so determined. I'm going to get her ears pierced. I keep hoping that her hair will finally grow over her ears so she'll quit noticing so much. So, and I guess it isn't offensive to me to have it done. I just didn't see any reason to have it. To me, it'd be one more thing to have to worry about to take care of, pierced ears. So everything went well. My only problem I really had was in communication with a couple people. There was a lady in the nursery itself who spoke no English at all. And I had a real hard time. I did not want my baby to be given bottles, especially because she was showing a great dislike for breastfeeding anyway at the beginning, and they kept trying to tell me no bottles, and then I walked in just as they finished giving her a whole bottle of formula, and then I was really furious, and I kind of went around, so then I started going around to all the nurses and saying, you've got to tell them to stop giving her a bottle, and finally they did, but those kind of problems were, it wasn't anything great, and most people there wasn't a problem, but communication is, golly, it's so important, especially in those situations. The other thing that was interesting, I chose to have a private, or a double room rather than a private room, just because it's quite a bit cheaper. And it was fine the first day I was in there all by myself, and then late that night, I got a roommate who was a Saudi woman, which was fine with me. The next day she was, because she had delivered in the middle of the night, she was pretty tired anyway. Didn't bother me too much. But then that next afternoon, I discovered the reason why next time I think I will want a private room. Because when it got to be visiting hours, oh, the family came. And the family wasn't just, you know, mom and dad. The family was a horde of women. I must have been 20 women in our little room. They all came in the same time. They all came in their abayas, and they were so excited, and they were laughing and talking, and they were kind of peeking behind the curtain. And pretty soon they were all lined up around the edge of my bed. I was sitting there with a book trying to act like, you know, I was reading this book. And they brought in big thermoses of tea and sweets, and all right away they were congratulating me up and down and bringing me tea and all this, and it was kind of an interesting experience. And luckily I think I had been given some candy bars, so I kind of broke those up and shared with them. But it was also rather overwhelming, and visiting hours went on for an hour and a half. This kind of went on and on and on. And so when finally a couple came to visit me, we ended up leaving the room to go visit somewhere else, because it was quite a gathering there. the one thing I don't like about, well, I do and I don't. One thing I didn't like was that children are not allowed to come up to visit you, so that Jenny couldn't come up to see either me or the baby. I had to go downstairs to see her in the lounge. The positive part about that was when I saw these huge Saudi families coming in, I thought, if they had their whole string of kids behind them too, it would really probably do me in altogether. So from as far as being a patient there, it was real nice that you didn't have a lot of children visiting. But that's the one thing that I felt badly about for Jenny's sake. So we took a Polaroid picture right away and brought to her. Then every evening I would go down into the main waiting area.
Did the men ever visit? Or was
it
always women?
Always women. The husbands only would visit.
But not like the aunts, the uncles and...
No, it was all women. And then the husband would come and go, and every time he came, then they always pulled their veil over, and then he'd leave, and they'd lift their veils up. And, I think I mentioned yesterday how the fellow, it was a fellow who brought our meals to our bed, and any time he came, then my roommate would throw a towel over her head, because of course she was just sitting there in her hospital gown. And yeah, she would throw it over her head, over her face. No, over her face. This towel, because she could hear the cart coming close, and then she would cover up. I kind of got a kick out of that, and pull the drapes around right away. And it does surprise me that they have a male doing that job, especially in the maternity ward where we're all half.
How long were you in the hospital?
Unclothed. 3 days. I think I was home on the third day. Yeah.
And is that your choice, or do you have to stay and?
No, actually, he kind of said that, you know, I could. On the third day, he said, you can leave in a day or two. And I said, why? I said, I want to go home now. Everything had gone fine. And, mm-hmm. you know, it was other people taking care of Jenny. So I think 3 days is pretty much the minimum. Mm-hmm. And then it's not really a problem leaving, as long as you've had a normal delivery and everything. So I think probably the tendency is going to be to try to get you to stay longer. Because now that so many Americans and Westerners have left the country, I think the hospital is starting to hurt. It's most of the Saudis, well not most, but yeah, I would say most, not all, go to the government hospital, which is free. And this hospital you have to pay for. Although according to American standards, I think it's very cheap. I think my whole bill, 3 days, everything was $600. So I think Jenny was like $1,500 mm-hmm. 6 years ago for, maybe I was in 4 days for her, but so it's, as far as we're concerned, it's still a cheaper way to go. So after that comes the interesting procedure of trying to register your baby, get a birth certificate. And that's an involved process, which I unfortunately wasn't involved in. John did it all. And we were in a bit of a hurry because she was born in November and we knew we wanted to leave the country in January during John's 2 week break. So it meant getting a passport for her, and you can't get a passport unless you have the birth certificate. And so it involved a lot of running around from one agency to another. And so she has a birth certificate in Arabic, and then one that is filed with the U.S. State Department. We went through the American consulate, which is right next to where we live. And so that's really her only birth certificate. It is mainly the real official one. It's just the statement that's filed with the State Department saying she is an American. And so at 2 weeks old, we had to take her down to get her picture taken for her passport. And that's in her passport now till she's 5 years old. And already, she doesn't look anything like she does in that picture. It seems to me so odd to have this, but that'll be with her till she's five. So a nice thing is having the consulate there is you can get a passport just about at the same day you go in there. Whereas it's going to be an involved process here, at least the last time. My parents tried to get one, or did get one a couple years ago to do some traveling. It took months and months of waiting and for this passport to come through. So for us, it's actually easier to just have it done there. It's not cheap, but it's easy. So then you have all these little babies to to contend with at home. And like I said, there is a real nice community spirit there with the little ones. And we have a baby group that meets once a week. And just about every nationality you can imagine is involved in there, which I like a lot. And it's more just for women to get together, especially those who are first-time mothers, have a lot of questions. And those of us more than first-time mothers who still can't answer those questions, we just get together and kind of share what's going on and everything. And that's a real nice aspect of being there, something I never had when Jenny was a baby. I remember feeling quite isolated with her because there weren't any other neighbors around that had little children. So it seems like at a very young age, they start sending, the parents start sending their children to schools of one sort or another, most of which are just private schools. Like I could, being a teacher, could have my own in my home. Some aren't even certified teachers, but have little daycare centers in their home in the mornings, which I considered, except our houses are so small anyway, and it takes a lot, I think, to set up an effective little
our
daycare.
Our supplies, like easy to come by then, crayons, paint, pencils, books, paper.
Just last year, they started an educational toy store. It's called Mantec, and it's wonderful. They've got just super toys, educational type manipulative materials. So I'm so glad that that's there now. That's otherwise, basic crayons and paper and things are easy to come by. But there wasn't much beyond that that was worth buying. So now with the store there, it helps a lot. But it's still, the women who run these daycares, let's see, how much do they charge? About $100 a month, I guess, for their children for half day every day. So if you have 8 or 10 kids, it can be kind of a lucrative business, but you have to put so much into it to get it started, just to get all the equipment and the supplies.
Do they have to go through any kind of course of instruction? Like they would be if you want to be
registered? No, you're not registered at all. You just advertise. And some women do it, I'm sure, who have no educational training. They do it more as a daycare type thing. But the women, there are several that start as early as 2 years old. And a lot of women feel like they need that time to get out and do their own thing. Now, until this year, the past 2 years, I chose to have kind of a preschool co-op with other women and that had children Jenny's age, where we just switched off every week. I would have them 1 week. We actually only met 2 mornings a week, too. And I found that to be a real good compromise there. I didn't really want to send her 5 days a week every morning at that age.
Carol, when you're talking about the daycare, are you talking about just within the international community?
Yes.
This is not something you necessarily find in the...
No, this is within our compound, within our international community. So it's just something that people sort of do for each other.
But for the average woman living in the country, she wouldn't have any access to special toys for the kids?
No, not really.
Yeah.
I think it must be much more difficult for her. Then again, if they're living in an extended family circumstance, there's a lot of interaction between the other children already. But I'm just real glad to have that there. That at the university, there's also an elementary school, a kindergarten, and a nursery school. But it's at first I was all enthused about it and thought I would send Jenny there. Half of the morning is in Arabic and half is in English. And I thought that'd be really a great way for her to get involved until I found out that a lot of it is indoctrination in the Quran and such, in which case my enthusiasm waned. So I haven't sent her there. And I don't regret that at all. I'm glad that I've done what I have with her.
So if you put them in public education, that's automatically what happens.
That's right, pretty much, yeah. That's just the way it is, I guess, because it's government. But there are some classes available for children. They have swimming lessons, and swimming is the one thing that we do a lot of, especially before I was working. Many, many mornings we spent up at the swimming pool. So you see little tiny ones at the university that are just like little fish. They jump off the diving board and they're in and out and around, and it's just because they're practically raised in the water, at least during the warm months. And that's nice. They have a little gymnastics course for children, and for a while they had a weaving class for children. But it all just depends on who's there, who has this talent that they can offer. And that's one thing we're feeling now. So many people are leaving the country because the economic situation is declining, that we're not getting all the opportunity there has been the past couple of years. There are not nearly so many classes available as there used to be. Another reason I was glad to get my job was because I found that there was less and less to do. Around all of our homes, we have a playground, which is a sand area with some climbing equipment and slides. And it's there that you get into the interesting interaction of children of different nationalities. And I'm so glad that my kids have that. But it saddens me sometimes to already see how prejudices form even at such a young age. And the thing that I've discovered, I think, is the barrier more than anything is the language barrier. It seems to be that it's when the children can't communicate that there's the problem there. And it's not that it's a different nationality, because they'll play very well together with other nationalities as long as it's in English. And so we get into little problems sometimes. Jenny has a little British boyfriend her age who already goes around talking about the Arabs, and he'll call Jenny and tell her not to go in the playground because there's some Arabic children in the playground. And I have to really work with her at that. And I was real proud of her one day because she was out playing and she came in and she was all excited and she said, "You know what, Mommy?" She said, "James is absolutely wrong." She said, "There's a little Arabic girl out there and she's so much fun to play with." And I was so glad to hear her say that, because when at 5 years old, they're already starting to say these kind of things about each other. And part of it is that the little Saudi children are really left to run wild. They're just are not reprimanded, especially the boys. The boys are spoiled rotten from day one, and they can just do as they darn well please, pretty much. And so lots of times it's hard for the kids when they have little bullies to put up with and such. But it saddens me, too, that then right away they start building these prejudices at such a young age, which I had hoped wouldn't be existent in that society.
Do you find that already begins to happen with the Arabic little boys, that they treat the girls disdainfully?
I think that they have as little to do with the girls as possible. They just kind of stick together, do their own thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like the girls, unless they're real little, you know, 2 and 3, they kind of come toddling out together. But as soon as they reach about the age of 5. But then, I mean, that happens a lot with my kids, too, at the American school. You know, Jenny still likes, she has her little girlfriends, and her and the boys kind of stick together. As much as I try to work against that, it kind of seems to happen. So it's, I remember that when we lived in Wisconsin, we had, for 2 summers, we took care of a little boy from Mississippi. It was kind of an exchange program. And I remember it striking me then, too, where one of the first days he was outside and some neighbor kids were over and I could hear them laughing at him. And I went out there all ready for, you know, this racial confrontation. And what they said was, "He talks funny." And they really weren't even noticing the color difference. But he had that very strong Southern accent, and it was that they were laughing at, and that they was the barrier. And I see that again now where we live.
He was black.
He was very black.
But if he'd been white, they would have still made fun of
him. I think so. It seems that way. So it's amazing what an early age communication problem enters in. And I feel a bit badly. I mean, I'd had visions in moving there of Jenny picking up Arabic from her friends, but because virtually everything's in English, that hasn't happened. And so the language barrier still remains. And that's too bad. Where I think in other countries, you wouldn't get that kind. You would get more of your children playing with the native children a lot more and picking up the language. At least friends I know who've lived in European countries and such, Japan. So generally, the children really like it there. Jenny was thrilled when we moved there from Portland, where we lived in a neighborhood where there were no other children for her, and the only way she could play with kids was for me to take her in the car and drive somewhere to visit and let her play. And here to have all these playmates right at her fingertips that she could run out of the house and go to their homes. Because it's a compound, there's only one main road that runs all the way around the outside, and so you virtually don't have to worry about your children. Plus, everybody seems to look out for each other's children, which is real nice when I mean, I still try to keep her fairly close to home because it's a big compound. But it's nice for me that she has friends right there. The only other activity that we do and do regularly is go to the beach, which I think is something, I don't know if I've known a child yet who doesn't like to go to the beach. And so that's how we spend many of our weekends, is going and playing in the sand. So then as far as schools go, school was something I hadn't even considered in moving overseas. And now I realize if we should go somewhere else overseas, what an important aspect that is to look into. But when we got the job, Jenny was only 3. And I remember getting a lot of literature from the university about schools and just ignoring it, thinking, it just didn't apply to me at all. And now since living there and seeing all the complexities of it all for the people living there, the expatriates anyway, it's really a major consideration. The school that most all of our children go to is called Dhahran Academy. It's part of the Saudi Arabian International Schools. That's where I teach. And it's very expensive, about $5,000 a year per child for the year. And our company, most companies do pay that for your children. That's one of your benefits. But ours doesn't pay until they turn 6. So we had to pay for Jenny last year to go to school. She just went the half a year while I was teaching. But for people who have to pay that out of their own pocket, that is a vast amount of money. And we have some friends, well, we met them over there. He actually went to graduate school with John, and they ran into each other in the middle of the street in Dhahran. They couldn't believe it. They looked at each other like, what are you doing here? And he was working for the Navy, actually. And they did not get educational benefits for their children. So their boy is turning 6, and they have just been keeping him at home to teach him. Well, now a new company has taken over their contract where education will be provided for them. But all these little things I never thought about before being overseas. Also, of course, there's no transportation provided by the school because it's a private school. So people who live out in town and have to pay for their children to go to school also have to arrange for a driver to pick their children up and take them, or arrange some kind of busing, and they have to pay for that. One lady I talked to a couple years ago was saying how they had to pay $30 per month per child for busing alone, and they had 3 children. Well, that's $100 a month almost just to get them to and from school, and then they were paying tuition on top of that. I mean, it soon gets to where you're not making any money at all if you have to pay those kind of prices. And I think the thing that's the hardest is that children of a Muslim family, even if one or the other is Muslim, the university will not pay for them to go to school. And there are many American Muslim marriages, not Saudi, but from other countries. And our elementary counselor, who's been there for 5 years, married a Lebanese fellow. And it didn't even dawn on me, she's American, it didn't even dawn on me that all these years they've been paying to send their kids to school because they're Muslim, the university figures, then they should be able to go to the Saudi schools for free. And then comes the big question of what to do when your children reach high school age, because the school only goes to 9th grade. And the British school doesn't even go that far. And so it's even harder for the Brits in the area to know what to do. Either they have to just leave and give up their career, or they have to send their children to boarding school, which many of them opt to do. It's because the British system has such a hierarchy of testing, and they have O levels and A levels and all these tests they have to take as they go through school. They feel like they should keep their children in the British system. And Dhahran Academy has a British-Dutch school that's separate from the American stream. And that runs in the British, with the British curriculum, and right. So that hopefully when they go back to Britain, they would just fit right into the system. But then the children, I think, are only 10 when there's no more opportunity for them there. So a lot of 10-year-old children are being sent off to boarding school, which bothers me no end, but a lot of people.
Is there no other alternative?
No other alternative, other than teach them at home, if you wanted to do that. But that's it. That's the only school.
Nothing on the compound that goes.
No, oh no. On the compound, there's only. Well, there's elementary, but that's completely Arabic. And then, like I said, the kindergarten nursery school is half Arabic, half English. But that's a decision I hope we never, I'm sure we'll never make, because I can't imagine sending. And then the trouble is that the university pays much of the boarding school. They pay a certain amount of money, and then if your child's at quite an exclusive school, you have to make up the remainder. But people get locked into this lifestyle then of having their children in very exclusive boarding schools. And then if their job runs out, then they're stuck. You know, it's hard. We find this with a lot of our British friends in particular, because a lot of people have been let go this past year, especially ones that have been there for many years. That now they're stuck with their children in fancy boarding schools. They don't want to pull them out. The teacher I was team teaching with, their son is in Swarthmore, I think a preparatory school, which is extremely expensive. And now they were let go this year. But the last thing they want to do is to pull him out of school. He's got one more year to go. So that gets to be a hardship for people. I think as your lifestyle changes, you start getting higher and higher expectations. And when it stops, then it's a real struggle for people. There's one family on campus who have a British family, and she's been running a morning day preschool program. Jenny went to her last fall before she started kindergarten at Darwin Academy. And this was their 16th year at UPM, and they were at the university, and they were let go, I'm sure, because he was making such a fabulous salary. And our immediate reaction was, who would need to work after 16 years of working there, especially since he was there during the real boom time where he was getting huge raises all the time. And the next thing we heard was now they had a job in Qatar. And I couldn't imagine that. But they have five girls, two of whom are in boarding schools in England, and I'm sure that's part of it. They just, now they're into that lifestyle. They want
to... Are they not aware, like you happen to be, that this might happen when the kids get to the age of boarding school, so that they could plan ahead?
Oh, yeah, they're aware, but I think it gets to be a trap for a lot of people. Just the lifestyle.
It didn't look like it was going to happen, though. It was just very recently that the economy...
That's right. It's really only this year that... That's right. Exactly. That's a very good point. I mean, they've said all along that oil prices would just keep rising and rising. Now there's been such a drop that I think this is the first year that people have ever been let go like they have. And it's the people who've been there the longest who are making the most money that are the ones to go out the door, which is only right. That's why we figure they'll never let us go, because we're at the bottom of the scale. I keep having the secret hope that we won't be offered a contract next year. Then we won't have a decision to make. It'll be made for us. But I have a feeling that we'd be the last ones to be let go. So that's a big consideration. Let's see. Well, then there's the whole area that I struggle with quite a bit, of how much are your children being indoctrinated by ways of another culture? What is it doing to Jenny to be seeing women always having to cover and not being able to drive? And it's something that we discuss a lot amongst ourselves. One friend of mine has a little 3-year-old boy who one day was refusing to let a little girl ride his little car because he said, "You can't drive." And actually, knowing the little boy, I think it was just an excuse. He isn't much for sharing his toys. But that was there. I mean, he knew that women shouldn't drive and she shouldn't be on his little car, and that was that. And I guess what the conclusion we've come to is our children just learn to live kind of this double standard, that they live that way and we live this way. And I can't see that it's doing any harm to Jenny. I hope not. But it bothers me sometimes that she does see this kind of thing. And she's very sensitive to it. She's sensitive to prayer calls when prayer call comes, and she knows that you know, the store isn't open. And even coming back here, we'll go shopping one day and she'll say, but what if it's prayer time, Mommy? You know, what are we going to do if it's prayer time? And I do the same thing. I find myself rushing through the store thinking, oh goodness, it must be almost prayer time. Then there were all the forbidden topics, pork and alcohol and such that, you know, don't exist. And yet, alcohol in particular, because there's so many people that make their own wine at home, which is fine as long as you do it at home and use it for your own consumption. But many of us have little kids then who are blurting out to other people about, you know, daddy making wine or daddy making beer. And some friends of ours, a little five-year-old, they were going through the store one day and she saw this bottled fruit juice that people buy to make wine. And she said, look, Daddy, there's some wine for sale. And, and she said, I said it's wine. Or, you know, and he was trying to cover her up. And Jenny has a lot of qualms about that. She was asking me if coming here, I think, on the boat, if that we had to be careful not to take any beer or something along. She made some remark about that. She's very sensitive about that. And they really feel it, the kids do, because of the security now at the airport. Why are they looking in our suitcase, and why do we walk through these, you know, so you get into all these topics that are kind of hard to deal with, saying that, well, it's okay for us and it's not okay for them. So we find that we do a lot of discussing along those lines. It's amazing how many times it gets brought up. Same with dress, you know, women wearing long dresses and why they can't wear shorts and this and that. So the best, like I said, all I can say that we've come to the conclusion is the children just kind of learn instinctively that there are these two ways of life and learn to live with it, I guess. But I hope that the long-term effect won't be one of, you know, male domination and such. We just have to live out our own life in our way as best we can, I guess. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. We find the same thing because there's a huge population, I've mentioned before, of men who are imported from third world countries to do all the rotten work, basically. Mm-hmm. All the menial jobs, and they've had to leave their families behind. And they love children, and they're always coming and picking up your kids. And on one hand, I don't want, you know, you can just see how important that is to them. On the other hand,
you have to teach your daughters, especially. You have to teach
them, exactly.
In our church atmosphere, we're always picking up our kids.
Right.
And it never occurred to me until one day I thought, hey, you know, I've never told them they can say no to these older
That's
men
right.
who want to play with them.
That's exactly
And they
right.
don't like it. So I've taught them, you can say no. You're not at the mercy of anybody,
mm-hmm.
no matter how much they... And that sometimes you miss out on.
Exactly.
You don't realize that at some point or another it infringes on their rights.
Right. Mm-hmm. I realized last year how Jenny was not afraid to go to anybody, a stranger,
yeah.
because she was so used to that.
Mm-hmm.
And not only picking her up and kind of playing with her, but giving her, oh, they always are giving her things at the store. She's come to, not so bad this year, but last year, to just expect when you go in a store, you're given a treat. And it struck me one day when there was an old man who was kind of, I think, you know, the same way, just, you know, a little kid to kind of ooh and ah over. But it struck me that she just went right up to him and probably would have... He could have picked her up and carried her off, and I don't think she would have had a second thought at all. So, yeah, that's another thing that we have to adjust to in coming back to the Western world. Unfortunately, one of the disadvantages. A good friend of ours had her baby at Kennedy Airport snatched from her, and luckily he was caught before they got out of the airport. But she said, too, just how lax we get over there because those things just don't exist. Mm-hmm. And you have a lot of strangers coming up to your children. And mm-hmm. Something that I need to remind myself of. Mm-hmm. Do you know if there were real cultural differences between you and the other children that your mother had to deal with?
Well, I remember my older sister, she knew how to speak Dutch, Spanish, and was just beginning to speak English. See, they were originally from Holland. They moved down to Venezuela, lived there for about 9 years, and then they moved down to Canada. First to Holland, then back to Canada. And my sister, so we're switching schools. My great mm-hmm. piano, when she arrived, she was a year behind when she arrived in Canada because of this, you know, the systems were all completely different, and she was having trouble communicating in English. And she went through a very difficult couple of first years, grade 1, 2, and 3, where she was picked on a lot, not because she looked different, she looked like any other Canadian child, but she had a funny way of talking. Mm-hmm. She was a little slower. She hadn't picked up a lot of that stuff, like mathematics.
Right.
Learned. Mm-hmm. And there was just a sensation that she was different and that she didn't quite belong. And the kids are very, they pick up on that stuff.
Boy, they do.
And they're very
quickly.
Cool.
Yes.
So she had a fight. She really had to be a fighter.
Huh.
And she punched out a couple of lights. You know, it was like she learned to deal with it that way.
Oh, it's amazing how young children can pick up on things like that.
Speaking of differences, on the other side of the spectrum, how kids sometimes don't notice differences.
Right.
Our daughter is married to a Navy career man, and they were in Hawaii for 4 years. And there's, of course, lots of Hawaiian children and black children. And one day, her little 4 or 5-year-old boy, I think he's not about that age, he'd been playing with this little girl, and he kept talking about Brenda, and his mother said, "Well, which one is she? I don't know who Brenda is." "Well, just Brenda, just a little girl." He couldn't describe her. Our daughter found out a couple of days later it was a little black girl.
Uh-huh.
He didn't notice any difference. She was just a little girl. And, you know, kids often, they don't have the prejudice.
That's right. They're so blind. The thing that struck me is I think they're more blind to color and then less to communication. That's a real positive side too. One real good friend of mine is from Zambia, and her husband is English. And they have a little 3-year-old daughter and then a little boy, Kristen's age. And Jenny said one day something about little Deidre and her, how nice and tan she was. And without even thinking, I said, "Well, of course her, you know, her skin would be darker like her mother's." I just about kicked myself for having said it because I realized Jenny looked at me like, "What are you talking about?" She absolutely had not realized that here was a black-white couple and, you know, the children, and that was just my own putting my foot in my mouth.
But eventually kind of they're not English.
Yeah, it's true. It always comes eventually.
We had a black South African minister come visit during the World Council of Churches. He was black, very
mm-hmm.
black, but as black as Sunny had ever seen. Sunny was into Snow White. she had lips blood red, and hair black as ebony when she put on black shoes. And we had told her that there would be a man coming, and he would look a little different than what she was used to, and his name was Willie. And fine, you know, he came, and the girls were very, you know, they had never seen anybody quite that black, but they could see we accepted them, so they slowly accepted. Well, Sonia came out in full regalia when we finally sat down. She had on her wig and everything, and she said, "I'm Snow White, and you're all black."
Thanks a lot.
What they wanted to do was touch her skin, and so she asked permission, "Can I touch you?" Because I've never felt black skin. He says, "Oh, sure, go ahead." I felt this twinge just for a minute, but it was quite comfortable, you know. They crawled right up on his lap and touched his skin. And I thought, now but because of that, they become very sensitive to skin color.
Mm-hmm.
So when there's other children in the area that move in who are from another, you know, Indian, Pakistan, they recognize the subtle skin differences immediately.
Uh-huh. That's interesting. Something about children, they are just so open, you know. And it's too bad that we start to stifle them at such a young age. Probably the thing that's hardest for me is with the religious difference. Trying to raise Jenny as a good Christian believer and yet as being tolerant of another religion. And we constantly get back to that. And I think it all started when my first realization was before we'd moved over there and met this Saudi couple in Portland and had them over to our house. And they have a little girl, just Jenny's age. And so the little girls were out playing in the kitchen while we were in having tea. And suddenly in the middle of tea, I realized what Jenny was doing was teaching little Fatiha how to make a little nativity scene. They were making the crib and the baby Jesus, and I heard, "And this one's mother, and here's Mary, and here comes Joseph." And I kind of froze. I thought, "Oh my goodness, what are her parents thinking of this?" So I went out and kind of casually suggested they change subject, and yet I hated having to do that. I really did. And it comes up a lot where we live, especially on Christian holidays, Christmas, when we and all of the other Christians on campus celebrate in our own homes. And Christmas Day, of course, all the kids are out with their new toys, and all the little Muslim children are standing there watching. And that struck Jenny that first year when she was only 3 years old, when she realized that they weren't getting presents. And it really bothered her. And to try to explain why it is that they don't celebrate Christmas. And I remember bringing up how they have their own holidays where they give presents at that time, and which she could handle. But that's one thing that bothers me a lot, is to try to be Christian and open, and yet on the other hand tell your kids, but you've got to be careful what you say, and especially around Christmas time. She was real sensitive to a little Egyptian friend of hers about bringing him into our house at Christmas when we had it all decorated, and you know, saying, what will I say to a mommy about this and about that? And I don't know how you reconcile that in kids. I feel like, I don't know if I'm producing a paranoid Christian daughter who doesn't know whether, you know, right from left, or doesn't know.
Well, we have that same thing in our country with Jews who do not recognize Christ.
Well, this is true. In fact, you know, that's something I was pretty much isolated from, coming from such a small Scandinavian Lutheran.
The Jewish gal was the first time I really realized.
Yeah. In fact, yeah, you're saying that reminds me how a lot of, I have some friends who are music teachers in Wisconsin, and that they're now no longer to have a Christmas program, music program. It has to be a holiday music program with Jingle Bells and Frosty the Snowman and all those. Yeah, I hadn't even thought of that. I don't know. I don't know if I, how much I should encourage. I'm afraid by constantly stifling her little evangelical streak that she has in her, that I may be putting the candle out altogether.
You have a special problem because you're in such an intolerant.
Exactly, country. That's right.
In another country, it would be a different situation.
That's true. We just have to be careful.
You're really up against a brick wall.
That's true. Yeah, that's probably the hardest part. Right.
And in trouble.
Right. Not that I imagine anything serious would happen from Jenny going around, but, you know, those things get back to the parents. And yet, you know, there a lot of tolerance must go on in their mind, with their children, too, mm-hmm. towards us. In fact, the same Egyptian family on Christmas Day was standing out in their patio and up from upstairs and looking over, and as they saw me, they waved and said, "Have a Merry Christmas," and I thought that was nice, and I wished them a happy Ramadan last month. So, but as much as I struggle with it myself, and how much I can say, and how much I should, especially this one friend in particular who's still grieving over the loss of her son, and I feel like there's so much I'd like to say and really can't. I guess you have to learn that right from childhood. But it's kind of a unique situation. In that way.
Well, is the missionary kids are new times.
That's, yeah, I wonder about missionary kids.
And
how
kind of in the same situation.
That's
they
true.
They go to a lot of different places, and they go out very accommodating.
I hadn't thought about that, missionary. Although on the other hand, they're
very well adjusted for the most part, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we looked into that because we were very worried about what it does to the poor psyche of the kids when
right.
they screwed up. And, amazingly, they don't. The majority of them are more healthy than the average children that you would
gather. That's good to hear. Although in that case, too, that they know that...
But you never know.
I know, you never know. I suppose in that case, the parents are there for that purpose.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I feel two-sided myself because I have to be so careful about what I say. Then we have our Christian fellowship in our home, you know, where we're singing hymns and reading from the Bible and praying, and then the next day, as soon as we're out of our house, we have to act like that never happened, kind of thing. So it's an interesting situation.
What would you, from everything that you shared, what would you say to a family with young children that might be contemplating doing something like this as far as encouraging or discouraging, particularly in Saudi Arabia?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess I certainly would not. I mean, I'm glad we've done what we've done, and I'm not upset about going back, you know, for another year. So I guess the thing that I would encourage the most is to find out just as much about the situation as you can. And we were so fortunate in that way that the university sent us such complete information. And not just information about the university, but the women's group had come up with it's called Notes for Newcomers Handbook that kind of talked about all these subtle things that come up. And so for us, it was real easy to adjust and not have any real shock, culture shock. On the other hand, I've met Western women who are just stuck in an apartment in town and find it very, very difficult. And I would too. I don't think I would have lasted as long as we have if we would have been in that case where there was no interaction with anybody else. Nothing to do whatsoever, you know. We have a beautiful recreation center that we use a lot. And there was one lady I met on the plane who, her husband teaches at university in Riyadh, the capital. And they're not given any housing. It's up to them just to find a place to live. I said to John, how in the world would we go about finding a place to live? There aren't ads in the paper and there aren't real estate agents to go to. The thought really frightened me of what we would do. And she was in the same situation because they were being forced to move out of one place and didn't know what they were going to do in the fall. And so actually, I'm glad we had enough intuition because we were offered two jobs over there. And that, from the start, I just knew from the complete literature from UPM that it was probably going to be a better experience for us. I don't know. I often wonder because we had applied for a job in the Philippines when Jenny was a baby, and it was working at a refugee camp. And we basically had the job, but then they said that it really would not be a very desirable situation for an infant because the housing was, I think it was more like living in a dormitory type thing. I was glad they were honest enough to tell us that rather than to get there and find it out. And then what would we have done? Kind of thing. Hi, girls. So, I mean, I've learned so much now that should we decide to go overseas again, I really know what to look for. Like I said, the whole education aspect had never even entered my mind before. And now I realize just how important that is. What schools are available? To what age level are they available? You know, what is the cost? Do you pay that yourself? Or because it's those kind of benefits that can make or break your situation that you don't even realize ahead of time. But I certainly don't regret doing what we've done. I think it's been a far more positive than negative experience, especially in our situation. The only other thing I just wanted to bring up briefly that is hard, kind of hard for me as a teacher at the international school, is that the school is completely American as far as curriculum goes. We have the Ginn and Macmillan series, and it all runs along those lines. And yet we have, I think this past year I had 13 nationalities in my classroom, only a handful of Americans. And yet we're teaching them such an American biased curriculum. It bothered me a lot at first until I talked to a teacher who had taught there for 7 years and overseas in lots of places for many, many years. And her point was that, I mean, people, this is what they want for their children. They know what our curriculum is. And it's their choice. They're aware of it, and it's their choice to send their children there. But in math, when you come to money, you study dollars and cents. Well, kids, and, you know, there's questions about how many, if you have 5 quarters and 3 dimes, well, what's a quarter and what's a dime? In fact, one day when I was team teaching, there was a substitute for the other teacher who was British, and she panicked. She didn't know anything about quarters and dimes and nickels and pennies, and I had to take over her class. We had to have a little lesson ahead of time with her, and then she kept looking at me and making sure that she was saying it all right. The kids had to take a test for a junior high, because I have 6th graders, that determines whether they take pre-algebra or basic 7th grade math.
And there were questions in there like, what is this, the diameter of a quarter? Well, you know, that's just so, half of the, or more than half of the kids had no idea. And they were all raising their hands saying, I don't know what a quarter looks like. And, you know, then some, like some of the answers to choose from were 10 centimeters. And I said, would you ever have a coin that was 10 centimeters? So they could sort of narrow it down. But there's just so many cultural things I feel like we're putting on the kids that bothers me a lot. I try to get away from that. I try to, we did a lesson on heroes a month or so ago. And of course, the whole class, who do they bring up about when we talk about heroes, but all Americans, you know, astronauts. And they brought up movie stars and rock singers, and they know them all. And, you know, they're arguing over Michael Jackson versus, I don't know even who else is in that category anymore. And virtually, you know, I think at that point we only had 6 in our class of 40 that were Americans. And so they had to each give a report on a hero. And so we stipulated it had to be a hero from their native country that they give it on. Oh, you know, the kids hated that because who do they know? Gal from Australia, you know, who's my hero? And so, but it was good for them. It meant going home and talking to their parents. But it was hard for them to get information on that person lots of times. And then they...
American books, that would be hard to find.
Well, that's it. I mean, when that's all you study, it's like yesterday in the talk yesterday morning with Susan about women in history and asking how many women famous women can you bring up out of history? And it was abysmal how many names we could come up with in our whole group, you know. And you think back on history books and you just think men, 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 men. And it's the same with them. They think American, American, American when it comes to history and such.